Welcome to Book Rising, a podcast by the Radical Books Collective.
Hi, Julianne. Welcome to welcome to this podcast, the Book Rising, which we do for the Radical Books Collective. And you're going to join a group of wonderful, trailblazing African feminist authors that we have happened to interview on this particular podcast. And you deserve to do so because your book, We the Kindling, your novel, which has just come out, is extraordinary, emotional, moving, and beautiful. And I'm so lucky and fortunate to have the chance to talk with you about it. And for those who may not know your work, I'm just going to quickly read out and say your full name and what you've done and what you've published. So Otonia Julianne Okorbitek writes poetry and fiction. Her first poetry collection was 100 Days, and it was about Rwanda and the genocide in Rwanda, and it was an extraordinary collection of poems and also an engagement with images, and it won a lot of lovely prizes. And then her second collection, A is for Acholi, was also a beautiful book and very recent, actually. And it's gorgeous illustrations, incredible engagement with just bookmaking, typesetting, imagery, all of those kinds of things. And of course, beautiful poetry. And you have had a recent collection known as Song in Dread. And We the Kindling is your first novel. You've also written lots of essays in academic journals for my magazine, Warscapes. And you are a multidimensional, multi-talented writer. And you were born in Kenya to Ugandan parents and have lived in Canada for many, many years. So we can start off by first congratulating you on this beautiful novel, really, really stunning. And then I just want to dive right into it and ask you, how did this come about? I know that at the end of the novel, you talk about the many years that you've been accumulating this material, been accumulating these stories. How, you know, how were you doing that? How did this all come together? How did you have the strength, the courage, the imperative? Tell us.
Thank you. First, thank you for having me in this podcast. I feel really, really privileged to be in conversation with you. Also for all the work that you've been doing over many decades, a couple of decades at least, with Warscapes. I remember reading Warscapes to know for myself the grounded ways of knowing what was happening in different parts of the world. And so it was an extreme privilege to be when you accepted my work over the years, and then just being in conversation with you, it's been really great. So thank you for having me. How did I get to be involved in this? In 2005, I met an extraordinary woman called Erin Baines. She's a professor at UBC, University of British Columbia. And she was working with women who had returned from abduction from the Lord's Resistance Army, which was fighting the government of Uganda from 1987. And so it was 2005 when I met her, and we struck up a friendship, and she invited me to see what we could do with the stories that women were telling, accounts about what had happened to them while they were in abduction and on return, because many children were abducted by the Lord's Resistance Army. Forced to fight, to bear children, to maintain the army. And the rest of the world knew them as child soldiers. Mm-hmm. And there have been works that have been written, many, many accounts of works about child soldiers from different wars too. Much of the focus has usually been on the boys, right, who grew into men, but not so much about the accounts from the women.
Wow,
and
okay.
So it was an invitation for me to write a war story from the perspective of girls and women, and also to contribute to documenting it, and also to present them as people more than what had happened to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the time we get locked into the definition of victim. survivor, right? We get to be known through the worst thing that has ever happened to us, right?
Absolutely.
And so I wanted to be involved in something that remembers, documents, but also presents people as whole people, like everybody else, right? Yeah. That's well, how I came to know to write it.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. And, you know, recently at a book club with Radical Books Collective, you talked about the difficulty of being part of the same region as Joseph Kony, of being Achola. You also have a collection of poems called A is for Acholi. I don't know if I'm saying that quite correctly. And you've written about this particular group before, this particular identity. You said something quite disturbing, which is that the Acholi would be called the Konis. And mm-hmm. I just want you to tell us a little bit about the history of this particular group and what is its, where does it kind of situate itself within Uganda, the nation in particular?
Mm. So the Lord's Resistance Army emerged from a time in Uganda where there was quite a bit of upheaval after Yoweri Museveni took over power in 1985. There was a bunch of resistance groups that rose up and fought, and many, most of them were quelled, either through defeat or through peace talks and things. The Lord's Resistance Army emerged in 1987, and they, as part of their process, they kidnapped mostly children, but also adults, and forced them to join their ranks, right? And so it was a horrific situation that the government found themselves in which they were fighting children and their own citizens who were forcefully conscripted, right? And this went on for decades. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, these children grew into adults, right? And one of the essays I wrote for you, Oppressive Silencing, I think it was, yes. I was reflecting on what it means to come from a people where children have been abducted into adulthood, and then in the process of their growing into adulthood, they have committed horrific crimes. One of them, Dominic Ongwen, has just gone through trial at the International Criminal Court, right? And so to come from a people who are known for child soldiering, committing atrocities at the highest stage in the world, highest court in the world, which also removes away from our everydayness, right? Right. So, it's a very heavy burden mm-hmm. to have to prove that you are not a rebel, you are not someone who wants to commit crimes, you are not,
right? Yeah.
Yeah, you are just a person. And so I don't even remember now where I was going with that. I just want to say that it was a challenge to, it remains a challenge to remember that Acholi are not just what we have been portrayed in the world to be in the last several years. We are also people with a proud history, with a relevantness, and with a nothingness like everybody else.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I want to describe to our listeners a little bit what I think the novel is. So it's called We the Kindling. And what it does is that it builds this collective protagonist. It takes these sets of stories of women, and they're all women, almost always. And it talks about it. Takes us through various themes. I mean, it takes us through the horror of them being kidnapped and taken and beaten and tortured and raped and all those humiliations and all those assaults upon the body. But it also takes us through friendship. It takes us through motherhood. It takes us through stories that are about rebuilding, about the difficulty of rebuilding. And of course, there's an overarching theme here of memory and forgetting, who gets to remember, how are the stories remembered. And it's a very carefully constructed novel. And what it does is it also brings in folk tales. It has little rhymes and poems that are I believe it's there in Acholi. And it creates this sort of symphony, a chorus of voices that emerges. And what was extraordinary for me is that I knew, of course, about Joseph Kony, and I know about the Lord's Resistance Army, and yes, I know about Uganda, by which I'm trying to say is not that I know everything, but it's that I see myself as the group of people that do know about some things in that part of the world. And yet, reading this novel, I sort of went into shock at the extent of how bad this was, at the long durée of how bad this was, and how, and I was left with, my gosh, how little I knew and how shocked I was. Mm-hmm. So with all that sort of in mind, I wanted to ask you, what do you think the novel is about? And I also wanted to ask you, who did you write it for?
Thank you for all of that. And I appreciate it because I thought I knew something about what was happening in my homeland too. And then after being exposed to, being introduced to, being welcomed into this community of women through transcripts, through interviews, through meeting them, I realized I did not know. I had no idea, right? So I know we had a conversation about proximity to witness when you're right there, when you come from there, when you're further removed, when you remember or you don't forget. And so for me, I was well aware of the impossibility for me, from my perspective, of being able to tell all the stories because there were so many. And so what We the Kindling is a representational, it's a small representation of what happened, right? And there are many stories that I did not include, not because they were not extraordinary, but I only used the stories that I could use to tell it this sure. way, right?
Yeah.
And so when I say that, I also wanted to say it became a project of storytelling because it's only through these women telling their stories that we could know what happened. But also storytelling as a practice, which is what we as humans practice across the world, is a way of knowing, orientating ourselves to the world, right, through story. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to write a book about storytelling that helps us to understand what happened to some people. Yeah. So that's a much more like an umbrella-like explanation.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also in terms of illustrating how I do it, right, I use stories to tell stories. And I also chose stories from different parts of Uganda. So there are some mm-hmm. from the beginning, which are stories from the south, because I wanted it to be not just an Acholi story, but a Ugandan story, right? Yeah. And I have stories in, stories that come from different places, not just in Acholi. Because I also didn't want it to be, that's what those Acholi people do or did.
Yeah.
I wanted to make it a contemporary. This is what happened in Uganda to Ugandan people, because part of our challenge was having to be seen, respected, accepted as Ugandan as everybody else, right? Yeah. Right, not just people who are rebels, right? Conies, mm-hmm. as they used to call us, right?
Oof.
Yeah, yeah. So and that name, which
it's
is
too
a
much
derivation of Joseph Kony's name. So always to make us in proximity to him, whether or not mm-hmm. we had anything to do with that, which is most of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So how does one shape this collective protagonist? I know you're such an accomplished poet, and I felt like blindsided. Suddenly, Julie has a novel. And and I guess there are multiple questions in here, which is, why a novel? Why did you decide to make it a novel? And then when you decided to make it a novel, you chose to do it in a way that wasn't some epic saga with like one family or, whatever. I mean, I love those novels. You know, you made it this incredibly sophisticated but extremely accessible narrative where there are multiple stories and the symphony of voices, as I keep saying. And so, yeah, tell us about the choice of A, writing a novel, and B, then bringing it together. It has some unity of voice, I guess is what I'm trying to say. There is some unity of voice, and that voice is, of course, your voice. But then there is this kind of many, many stories. And it's a very, it's not easy to do, I know. As a literary critic, I know that that's hard. And very few writers actually successfully manage to create this choral protagonist or collective protagonist. It's easier actually in film sometimes to depict that. So tell us how you tackled this material and why the novel, a novel.
So I knew over time that I'd have to move from creative nonfiction, which is where I had started from, into fiction. And the reason why creative nonfiction, because I came to realize that fiction can, I mean, nonfiction limits what stories you can tell. I, writing from Canada, I would have no way of proving that this happened to this person on this day by this time, right? Which are some of the demands of nonfiction. And so I would have to rely on fiction to help fill in the gaps, right? Or to be able to tell the story, and which sometimes I say, fiction was the only place where I could tell the truth, right? Because in other genres, you'd have to be limited by the demands of the genres, like facts and dates and names.
Yeah.
Right? And so I knew I was having to rely on fiction. It also then helped me to bring in storytelling, like using folklore and using animals and other beings to help to tell the story, because some of these places and times, there were no other human witnesses who could tell the stories, right? And some of those stories could not properly be told from the perspective of the people who had been in it.
Yeah.
And so I needed to find some other way to tell it. But the first person plural is terminology that I got from Sophie McCall.
Oh my God, what is that? I'm just kidding. All those grammar lessons. We're all been colonized by the English grammar. Yeah, go on.
No, but you know how to say we, that is at once I and also more than I, right?
Beautiful.
It would help me to gather stories that were told in a similar way and not have to rely on a specific I. Right. Mm-hmm. So it felt like a math problem for a long time. Right. I also don't know how to write long stories. I love reading long narratives. Right. Well, I don't know about love. I appreciate long narratives when they're told well, but I don't know how to do it. And so coming from poetry, where my writing is mostly focused on the moment, I knew that if I write fiction, what I do relatively well is to write about moments. And so then I'm not bound to plot as a sequence of events, right? And then I also needed to connect, because many of these women met after they returned.
Wow.
And so they got to know each other afterwards, because many thousands of people were taken, right? Tens of thousands of people were taken. And so how do you create a story that is not only being told from the afterwards? And so fiction allowed me to connect them during abduction as well, right?
Yeah.
So it just seemed to be a place where things can work. And then if I called it, or if it was a collection of short stories, it would not really work. Because each part of it is helping to tell a longer part of it. So, and they're all really connected, and together they told one story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think you asked me before, what do I think it's about?
Yeah. I just want to hear from in your words, because I feel like, you know, because the narration has this sparseness and this accessibility, and we are drawn into this intimacy of these women's worlds, their bodies, what they're experiencing. I feel like it's very easy for anyone who reads to be like, that's what this book is about. That's what I got from it. I just want to know from you, you know.
Okay. For me, this book is about storytelling.
Okay.
Because it is storytelling through which we can tackle whatever it is through. It is storytelling through which we can tackle how we are oriented in the present.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And without the ability to tell the stories, then we would have to fall back on the statistics, the news, the everybody else's way of doing it. Right. But storytelling as a form is what I think the book is about, because then it welcomes other ways of telling. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's
but
lovely.
it also honors the practice and cultures where I come from. Somebody once told me, and this is my absolute favorite way of thinking of who Acholi people are. So we are actually a part of a wider group of related communities, languages, people who speak the Luo language, L-U-O, right?
Yeah.
So even in Kenya, there's the Luo people, in Sudan, in Tanzania, in the Congo, Uganda. And so Luo, if you properly pronounce, someone might say Luo, and Luo are people who gather around a fire, right? And the people who gather around a fire are people who are telling stories, right?
Beautiful.
So that makes me know that storytelling is really foundational for who we are.
Right? Yeah, I see.
It might not be the actual reason behind it, but it's my favorite way of thinking about who we are. So as storytellers, how do we present ourselves in the world? Acholi people are also relatively very few in number. I think the last statistics I saw is 2.5 million people. And when you come from a country of over 40 million people, 2.5 is very, very small, right? So numerically, we don't exist, right?
Right. Wow.
Except through stories. And land.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Which of course leads me to the question I think I know you've been getting, and that people have been saying in reviews and people spoke about in our book club as well, is this question of storytelling and its related activity, witnessing, you know, because yes, you bear witness to these things that happened over a span of so many years, 60,000 children kidnapped, many, many are gone forever. All those women, some are back, many are gone forever. And the book bears witness by making narrative of them, giving life to them, infusing them with beauty, with you know, by just kind of giving us insight into their minds and lives and all those kinds of things. So you're doing this particular thing, you know, that we often associate writers of doing. So what do you think about this act of witness? Do you think you succeeded? Do you think it was an intention?
Oh, it was definitely an intention.
Mm-hmm.
I did my best.
Whether
I succeeded or not remains to be seen, but I did my best. And it was important to me to write this story from the perspective of a voice that be familiar to the women, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, using the accent that would be specific to a region, right?
Okay.
So when you hear someone speaking, they might be speaking in Acholi, but have written it in English. But the particular way of speaking that English would be from that part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the questions is, what do I sound like when I'm telling this story, right? And then this makes it a story of perspective, right? And the perspective is not mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to take myself out of it. And early iterations of this novel it had a very angry tone. And I realized that anger was mine. So I also had to remind myself that this is not about me. This is about us.
But why not let the anger be?
Because it's not
about me. What's wrong with
anger? It's not about me.
Okay.
And so if you were to read anger into it, you would be, okay, if I was to read anger into it, I would be aware of this anger at the expense of other ways of thinking about the story. So what happens, say, if I needed to infuse it with love? I couldn't because I was so angry, right? Or with friendship, or with tenderness. There's a story I write called My Son is a Story, which mm-hmm. I wrote in response to a BBC newspaper article. Okay. And so I wanted to contrast the perspective of a newspaper article with a woman telling the story of her son, mm-hmm. right? An angry tone would not do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I understand. I understand what you mean. Yeah, it would not be enough, perhaps. It would not be enough, perhaps. It would not do justice to all the stories, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Your first, you know, for me, what was your first kind of complete book? I know you had written essays and published in various places before, was 100 Days, which was about the genocide in Rwanda. And when I read this book, the word genocide was floating in my head. And I don't want to use that word lightly. I don't know what the courts have said, you know, all that. But just this, the focus on erasing childhoods, whether that's killing children or whether that's robbing them of their childhood, you know, the inability for them to beget next generations. There's a genocidal intention in there, or, you know, and I know genocide by definition is meant to target a specific group of people and things like that. So within all those constraints, maybe the word doesn't apply, but the fact that you started, that you wrote 100 Days, and I know geographically Uganda is close. I'm sure you know people. I know you, I'm sure you felt it in ways that you can. But now when I read this book, I wonder if there was some sort of transference going on that you needed to engage with that. But actually you were engaging with Uganda, with Northern Uganda, with Kony and all this stuff. You know, is there something there, or am I over imagining?
Yeah, there is something there. So the last poem in 100 Days is written primarily in Acholi, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to mark that. And also geographically, we share a border, Uganda and Rwanda share a border.
Yeah.
And the 1994 genocide was not the first genocide in Rwanda, right?
Yeah.
So in the 1960s, and this is now a story from my family, late 50s, early 60s. I don't have the dates with me right now.
59, I think. Oh, no, you're talking, I'm talking about the Rwanda, those various incidents.
Yeah, there was something in Rwanda in the late 50s, early 60s. Mm-hmm. My mother was very young then, and she and her sister were growing up in with her grandparents, right? So my great grandparents. Mm-hmm. And so I think we get the story from my auntie, who says that one time she remembers some very tall and emaciated people showing up in their homestead looking for help, right? And so my great-grandfather, who had his reputation for being a very generous man, he welcomed these people and let them stay. And they were Rwandan refugees, right?
Of course.
And they said that it was the first place that they had been welcomed to. So you can imagine from Rwanda walking all the way up to Gulu in northern Uganda, right? Trying to look for help. So stories of sometimes we think of them as geographical places. They touch our families in many, many, many different ways. Mm-hmm. At the same time, right now, I have a family from Rwanda too, because, you know, we intermarry, we have kids from everywhere, as we do, right? So I remember distinctly when the 20th anniversary happened, I was thinking to myself, what do we tell our kids in the future when they ask, when this was happening, what did you do? What did you say, right?
Yeah.
And so that, I was writing that at the same time I had already finished drafts of We the Kindling, what is now We the Kindling, right?
Wow.
So it was already there, trying to still muscle its way into the world properly. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen since written 3 books of poetry. And so people know me as a poet, but I'd already been working on this novel too, right?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can't remember what you were trying. So I guess...
No, why the Rwanda came first?
Yeah.
That it was, you're wrestling with all of this at the same time is the answer I'm hearing.
Okay, so the other part of it, they were using the term genocide. So when Rwanda was happening in 1994, there was also Serbia, Bosnia, Serbia, and
yeah,
there was also Darfur.
Yep.
Right? And there's also one other place which kills me that I can't remember right now. So I think there was 4 genocides that we were aware of at the same time. But I remember very distinctly knowing that the numbers, in terms of numbers which were being compared,
mm-hmm,
people in Acholi were dying at horrific numbers.
Wow.
Children were being taken in their thousands, right? So some people say at least 60,000 children were kidnapped, right? Many of whom never returned. But the distinction and why there were avoidance of the word genocide was that it had to prove intent.
I know.
Right? And so it was very difficult, and I think it remains so, for anyone to say that the government of Uganda intended to eliminate Acholi people, or that the Lord's Resistance Army intended to eliminate Acholi. So
mm-hmm,
because the word intent was not, could not be proven,
yeah,
it could not be used. I have since come to know that we need our own terminology. We cannot rely on the language of other people.
Yeah.
Right? To talk about what we happened to us. And I've also thought about the work of Toni Morrison. I keep her very close to me. And say when she was writing Beloved,
mm-hmm,
right? And how she has talked about the importance of writing the interiority of people's lives so that they're not only marked by what happened to them. In terms of African Americans, they were more than people to whom enslavement happened, right?
Exactly.
And so the political project of writing the interiority of people's lives and giving them voice and opportunity to write, tell their own stories in their own voices, how her characters do,
mm-hmm,
It really encouraged me to think about writing as a form of listening, right?
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. And I think with regards to the term genocide, I agree. I don't know what language, where it can be born, but, you know, we are bystanders, consumers, witnesses to things that are happening in Palestine. You know, Sudan has just filed a case for genocide. And while all this language may proliferate, I don't know what it's doing, or I don't know who it's helping. And, you know, I didn't know what was happening in Rwanda. There was no communication, was just not that sophisticated then, you know. It was just like something in the newspaper or whatever. And, or in Bosnia or anywhere. It wasn't vivid the way it is today, you know, the footage that we are seeing today. But in a way, like, it's almost feels like it doesn't endure anyway, like the way we're receiving all this stuff now. So in a way, the material act of holding this novel or a full complete story or a full complete book may kind of, in the long run, may be the only way we can think about these things. I mean, I'm just feeling very disillusioned with all this, like, oh, we're witnessing something, but it's like, and then what? And then it keeps going and keeps going and keeps going, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I feel this gesture towards a longer, that will stay, that will have a bigger literal shelf life, is the grander gesture, the more important one, perhaps, at the end of the day, is what I'm trying to say. But coming back to We the Kindling, beautiful title, let's talk a little bit about how you deal with with violence. You know, before I read your book, I had just finished reading and also teaching for a seminar, Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments by Saidiya Hartman. And it's a very, and, you know, it had taken a kind of toll, but not in a depleting way. And the toll was from just the amount of assault on the women's bodies, the rapes, the stuff they endured, the labor, the indignity, the constant tiring, exhausting labor that is described again and again. And it's a horrific, triggering, traumatizing book. But at the same time, it never left me depleted. It still left me with these lives as having had meaning, having had beauty, having had joy. It didn't leave me feeling like, oh, these women were just victimized and that's all they were. And your book has the same effect. You don't shy from saying the things that happened to them. It's not graphic in that way. It's not pornographic in any way, but it doesn't shy from telling what happened. But at the same time, it doesn't leave us depleted. The violence doesn't make you repulsed or make you close the book. You still get a full arc. And how did you navigate this way of depicting them? It must have been a tough, formal way while you were writing.
Yeah, thank you for that question. And it's a question about process, right?
Yeah.
Also about intent. I had no appreciation just how terrible the experiences were of the women who were, and I think the word is brave enough to put word, to try and put words to say what happened to them. And so I think a little bit of background, Professor Baines at UPC she was working with formerly abducted women from the Lord's Resistance Army and providing space for them to come and tell their stories and share. And so a community was created between these women, communities of trust. She was working with two particular women, Ketty Anyeko and Nancy Appeal. And those two women were instrumental in making trust between them, right? So Nancy and Ketty were not abducted, but they're also actually women. And so Erin Baines is a Canadian researcher, right? So she was coming from an outsider perspective, but as somebody who wanted to be in this work as well. And so they told their stories, and the more you trust, the more you can tell, right? And I exposed myself to these stories. Exposed myself. Almost sounds pornographic. I'm not meaning that. But I
yeah.
I was exposed to these stories, and they had a horrific toll on me because I started to have nightmares. I started not sleeping well. And when I slept, I had nightmares. I started hearing things. I started crying at the drop of a hat. I had a time of very, very poor mental health because I was obsessing on how do I tell these really horrific stories without harming the people who will read it. Because if you want people to read it and witness and be witness to that level of proximity, you can't be shutting them off from knowing what happened. And horror shuts people off, right?
Yeah.
And I was not interested in horror for the experience of horror, like people choose to go to horror movie films, right?
Yeah.
I was not interested in the cathartic effect of, you know, oh, that was so scary. but I wanted to be able to tell these stories and care for the reader, not by sanitizing it, but to care for the reader enough that they would have a glimpse and fill in the gaps to the extent that they can for themselves, right? I don't need to be. I also wasn't there, right? So I was filling in the gaps too, and fleshing it out, so to speak, right? But I also had the remaining stories that I wasn't able to write out or to think through, like remaining in myself, and I was frustrated. Over time, I realized that this is not about me. Therefore, in order for me to do it, I have to be able to take better care of myself in order to be a good witness, a good sister, right? Alongside these women, right?
Yeah. And then
part of it then was also, I shared all of these with Erin, right? She got some funding. She let me buy some time to write some of these stories, and I shared them with her. I sent some of them to publication, and there's one particular one which I was struck by the response back from the women in Uganda, who said of one particular story that it's as if I was there, right?
Wow.
So I had managed to write it without them feeling that they had that aspect of their lives had been seen, right?
Yeah. Ah, tremendous, tremendous responsibility.
Oh yeah, yeah. But yeah. At the same time, fiction being the place where you can tell these stories,
mm-hmm.
and have no one come at you and say, "Prove it," right?
Yeah, of course.
So it's also protective, sort of.
Yeah, and it is the higher truth. It can get at more, I think, at the end of the day. And then how did you take care of you? Because even reading the book, I felt like, because I have known you for so many days, I was like, oh my gosh, how is she doing this? You know, one doesn't always know the writers of books. But in this case, I did happen to know you. So I know what you look like. I know what you sound like. So I was like, my gosh, you know, who is taking care of her? Like, how is this going? So how did you protect yourself? Because you have to keep doing to finish the work.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I shouldn't say it goes without saying, but it kind of does go without saying. And that at the back of the book, I have a huge list of thank yous to individuals.
Yeah.
That I could not have done this if I didn't have the people around me mm-hmm. who made sure to not let me fall, right? Because mm-hmm. I stumbled for a long time. I was just stumbling through my life, right?
Yeah.
I was precariously employed. I was going through a difficult PhD. I had relationship issues. I had teenagers.
Yeah, yes.
Right. But I always had a community of people who I could rely on.
Yeah.
Right.
That's great.
And I think it's also a function of time. When you get to know people long enough, they mm-hmm. see you as is. You don't have to be anybody else, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I've had a remarkable group of friends and family. Right?
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
But I also learned to stop being foolish in terms of stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't on purpose seek out hard stories, which I used to. When I did my master's degree, I did a course on, American war film.
And wow.
I watched so many war movies, and I was like into it, and you know. And then,
oh my God. What?
And then I had my bit with, you know, Holocaust studies and trauma studies, and without thinking that you have to have ways of managing, because these stories get into you, and if you have no way to get them out, then you can screw yourself over, right?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Well, I'm going to ask you, one of the things about the book is also, for me, is a redrawing of like East Africa a little bit, you know, like you have characters that go into Sudan, what is now South Sudan, you know, places like that. So I think it does a lot for East African literature, which is an interest of mine. Mm-hmm. And I think more and more work is coming out of Uganda, though it's not specifically this. And it's kind of intense how different the books that come out of Rwanda or out of Uganda are. Like when you think of Makumbi, Jennifer Makumbi, she does a certain type of fiction. Then when I was thinking recently, I met Janika Oza, who wrote about mm-hmm. Amin and the mm-hmm. and the Asian community, you know, and then you writing about the Acholi community and the LRA and all this kind of stuff. It's like so many Ugandas, but in a way also so many, such a kind of vastness of just thinking about East Africa. I mean, I guess that's more of a comment than than a question as well. But I wanted to ask you which writers you were. I know you read so widely, and I just wanted to ask you which writers you were influenced by very directly, and specifically maybe were there writers from the region, and then of course, whoever else.
So let me comment a little bit about the Ugandan
Okay,
novel
good.
writing, right?
Yeah.
So soon we'll see a novel, another novel coming out of Uganda by Irene Tushabe called, oh my God, I forgot already. but another exciting new novel coming out of Uganda.
Okay.
What all of these writers have in common, me included, is that all this work is steeped in historical time.
Yes.
Right? And so this highly imaginative but also specifically located writing, right, which goes and not redraws borders, but it allows us to imagine, as you say, the many Ugandas, the many perspectives, right? And it's a country which is made of so many communities. I remember Makumbi's Chintu, and how it required a foreword by an American scholar, right? And how I was so relieved to have to read a novel that did not focus on colonialism, right?
Yeah,
which is also a true way of reading a people who are themselves, which are without having to think that everything has, like, planes that have to always go to Europe before they can go anywhere else.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But in Acholi specifically, we don't have a tradition of much of a tradition of writing fiction. In part because the publishing industry has not done us in Uganda.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it hasn't supported writers very well. But then at the same time, poetry has always been much more, I don't know how to say this, but poetry is a much more
accessible. Mainstream, almost.
Thank you, yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, also coming out of the war, it was from a time of having nothing and horrific destruction and everything, straight into spoken word and rap and very contemporary way of young people cultural production,
of
right?
Of course.
Right. And so novel writing, which usually is a much longer project and requires stability, is not something that many people can afford to do, especially when there's no very little hope of getting it published. And you know, lots of writers, even Ugandan writers, even the ones you've mentioned, are published abroad, right?
Yeah.
But it would be, for me, amazing to think about. All right, let me go back a little bit. I once heard a Black Canadian writer saying that she just wants to write about strawberries, right?
Okay.
Because, and I think from what I read in that comment was that there's the pressure of Black writers to always be responding to the political situation of Black people, specifically
sure.
having to do with racism and for many women having to do with sexism and, you know, or the different phobias, right? Transphobia, homophobia, and all that kind of thing, right? And so when will some of us writers just say, I just want to go into imagination and do whatever it is people who go into imagination do? And thinking about the location we are as some kind of shackle that always keeps us on the ground in time, right? That's also amazing and relevant work to be done. But there's so much space for our imagination.
Yeah.
So much space, right? In Acholi, honestly, and this is probably my ignorance, I only know one other Acholi novelist, and that's my dad.
That's good you bring up your dad, because I did want to expose you as coming from literary royalty, because your father is the brilliant, canonical, celebrated poet who wrote Song of Lueno, and he's actually, and he writes about that world, that life, and it's this sort of amazing thing. And then you've landed again into some kind of literary royalty, because I just found out that your novel was edited by the brilliant Dion Brand. So, you know, you're just walking around with these halos. Tell us how that feels.
Oh, well, you can see me with the tiara on my head.
Yeah, you should have one. You'll own it.
But, I actually have a tiara at home, and I usually wear it when I'm marking.
Oh, my God.
Okay. But even my dad, as well mm-hmm. known as he is, he's mostly known as a poet, right? Yeah. He also did other scholarly writing, but it's mostly known as a poet. Mm-hmm. He did a small novel, right, called White Teeth, which he wrote in Acholi, and mm-hmm. then he translated into English, and he called it, and the book in Acholi is called Lakta, which is white teeth, which is taken from a proverb saying, you know, I only laugh because my teeth are white, because my life is so miserable that if you see the whiteness of my teeth, it's only an account of, you know.
Wow. And then Zadie Smith plagiarized that? I'm just joking.
Oh, so don't even get me started, because I know.
What?
No, you know what? White Teeth is a novel about a young man who comes from Gulu, goes to Kampala to look for opportunities, right? So mm-hmm. goes to the city, and then his relationship with being in the city and then returning home, right? And then White Teeth, about this Jamaican family in the city, yeah. and all that kind of thing, right? And then it's called White Teeth. Whatever. They did not do their homework. And if they did their homework, they didn't care. Whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to hold it against them, right?
Fine.
But I can also say that there are two novels by Black writers called White Teeth.
Wow. Okay.
So, I knew that We the Kindling could not be poetry mm-hmm. because in the poetry that I write, the work of the words is, so the page is a place of play and experiment and possibility. Mm. We the Kindling is not that, right? So the writing would have to be doing something else, mm-hmm. right? And it's not a place for play anymore, I don't think.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, your poems are not places for play, but
but in terms
I see what you mean. Yeah. You mean like, yeah, language, linguistic experiments and things like that. Yeah. I understand. Right. I'm happy it's a novel because it'll just reach more people. And the novel is the popular form. And yes. Poetry is a dangerous form, not just because it can be politically dangerous, but poetry is also, people are literally frightened of poetry because they're like, oh, I won't understand it. I don't understand it. You know, you just have to flow with it. And that's fine. You know, people always feel like puzzled to read poems. So it's good to have the story, that mm-hmm. novel forces you to be in the story world. But mm-hmm. I asked you before, writers that influenced you. Yeah. Let that be my final question to you.
Okay. So writers that influenced me, specifically novelists that influenced me, right?
Yeah, for this book, yeah.
Oh, for this book, oh my God, I don't know.
Or too many? Okay.
No, not that it's too many. It's that I've had to turn to thinking of myself, to giving my role as someone who wrote a novel some kind of legitimacy, because I felt that the ground was shaky for me, because I've been a mm-hmm. poet, and being a poet in the world is different from being a novelist, right? Mm-hmm. But I've always had Toni Morrison close to me, right? And Toni Morrison, as somebody who writing fiction was a political project, and she talks about that, right?
Yeah.
So for me, she's the foundation for thinking about what the novel can do and what the novel has done for imagination of Black Americans in America cannot be understated. She won the Nobel Prize for it, right? Mm-hmm. But in more recently, the work of Adonia Shibley, specifically Minor Detail,
my God,
where she has two novellas, one in the present day and one in the 1940s, and have them in conversation, whereas they don't even speak to each other. Right? Mm-hmm. Right. So it has just reminded me that novel writing is more than entertainment. Mm-hmm. Right? I really appreciate that. So many writers. Han Kang, the vegetarian.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You like her.
How to Become a Tree.
How to Become a Tree.
Well, because
that's Sumana's novel, Sumana Roy's book.
No, in The Vegetarian, the woman becomes a vegetarian in a meat eating community, and then she just wants to become a non person and she wants to become like a tree, right?
Okay. Yeah, I know a book named that. I see. That's interesting. I thought, I feel like I remember you also loving Scholastic Mokasongas. Kibogo, was it? Or, yeah, maybe Kibogo.
Indigo and
Barefoot Woman.
Barefoot Woman, and because she's writing also, Scholastica Mukasonga has been writing about the novels
Rwanda.
about Rwanda, but from different historical times, right?
Yeah,
And in her
absolutely.
work, she always situates the Rwandan culture and people as central to telling the story, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And she comes from a lot of loss from that, almost 27 members of her family and things like that.
And also Yolande Mukagasona, she's a poet. And
Oh yeah, Yolande,
I wrote 100 Days for, dedicated it to her. I
Wow.
met her in Colombia, and she told us she began to write poetry after her family was killed. So you remember that whole business of you can't write poetry after the Holocaust? That was Adorno, right? And so meeting this woman in real life who started to write poetry, I was like, oh, okay, it is possible. It is. So you know how some people say, I have no words, or there are no words. If Mukasonga can find words, what are you? Then we're just not working hard enough, right?
And in the book club, you said Darwish, Mahmud Darwish was
Oh
also.
my God, yeah. Mahmud Darwish was so important for me. So important for me.
Why?
I would feel lost in the horror of the stories from Northern Uganda. And because Mahmud Darwish was a Palestinian writer writing in exile, his work, his poetry always grounded me. To remember that, you know, you can still think of yourself as coming from a beautiful people, and I'm not thinking about aesthetics. I'm thinking about people who are beautiful in the world. They produce good things. They are solid people. They tell stories. They love each other, right? So the loving relationship between Mahmoud Darwish and Palestine, the land and the people, and how he did his work to honor that, right? I used to read it a lot, a lot.
And there is a story towards the end of a woman named Tony, or then it turns out her name, who has lost her memory. And when I read that, I did feel like I'm part of something Darwish-like in that, in this idea of forgetting, amnesia, memory, remember, dismember, all those kinds of things. So I felt that connection with him there. It's intense. It's amazing.
Thank you for saying that. I just somebody was telling me, actually it was Erin Baines who was telling me a couple of days ago, because I'm learning so much from this book by listening to other readers, that the story of this woman, Tuone, which ends with her remembering her name. She said that's the beginning of her story, because it's only when she remembers her name and words that she can tell us everything that has happened to her, right? So the shape of that story was also interesting. I thought, oh yeah, that's true, and it's very, very cool, right?
Wow. Okay, that's beautiful. I'm going to thank you for having this conversation with me, and I'm going to urge everyone who's watching to please get We the Kindling right away and read it. And
Thank you.
thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Bhakti.